and so she also bought for herself small hanks of dyed silks. It would be pleasant to weave on such brilliant colours, restful and fine to her hands after the coarseness of wool and flax. She would teach more gauze, too. And it would be high time next year to teach Morgaine to spin. If she indeed bore Gorlois another child, this time next year she would be heavy and ungainly, and she could sit and teach her daughter to spin. 4 years was certainly old enough to start learning to handle a spindle and twist the thread, even though the thread wouldn't be good for much, except tying up bundles of yarn for dyeing. She also bought some coloured ribbons. They would be handsome on Morgaine's holiday gown, and they could be taken off each dress as the child outgrew it, and sewed at neck and sleeves of the new gown. It was only fitting, now that she was big enough not to soil her clothing, that she should be dressed suitably for the daughter of the Duke of Cornwall. The market was doing a lavish business. At a distance she saw the wife of King Uriens and other well-dressed ladies, and she wondered if every man in the council who had a wife had sent her out to do her shopping in the markets of Londinium this morning while the debate raged. Igraine bought silver buckles for her shoes, even though she was sure she could have bought some just as fine in Cornwall, simply because it seemed a fine thing to have buckles to her shoes, which had come all the way from Londinium. But when the man would have sold her a brooch with silver filigree all around an amber stone, she refused, shocked at spending all this money. She was very thirsty, and the display of men selling cider and hot pies tempted her. But it seemed an ugly thing to sit and eat in the open market like a dog. She told her man to come along back to the lodging, and resolved that there she would have some bread and cheese and beer. The man looked sullen, so she gave him one of the tiny coins left from her marketing, and told him to buy himself a pot of cider or ale if he chose. When she got back to her lodging, she was tired and sat listlessly looking over her purchases. She would have liked to begin work at once on the borders, but that must wait till she got back to her small loom. She had some spinning with her, but she felt too dull to do it, so she sat looking at her things until Gorlois, looking weary, came in. He tried to take an interest in what she had bought, commending her frugality, but she could easily see that his mind was elsewhere, though he admired the ribbons for Morgaine's dresses, and said that she had done well to buy the silver buckles. "You should have a silver comb, too, and perhaps a new mirror. Your old bronze one is scratched. You can let Morgaine have the old one. She is a grown girl now. Tomorrow you may go and choose one, if you will."
"Will there be another meeting of the council?"
"I fear so, and probably another and another, until we can argue Lot and the others into doing Ambrosius's will and accepting Uther as High King," Gorlois grunted. "Stubborn donkeys, all of them. Would that Ambrosius had left a son. Then we could all swear him loyalty as High King and choose a war duke for his prowess in the field. There'd be no question then, it would be Uther. Even Lot knows that. But Lot is damned ambitious to be High King, and sees only that it would be a fine thing to wear a crown and take oath from all of us. And there are men in the north who would rather have one of their own, and so they back up Lot. Indeed, I think if Uther is chosen in the end, all the kings of the north, except perhaps Uriens, will ride away north with no fealty sworn at all. But even to keep the loyalty of the kings of the north, I'll not swear to be Lot's man. I trust him no further than I could kick his arse on a muddy day."
He shrugged.
"This is dull hearing for a woman's ears, Igraine. Set me some bread and cold meat, if you will. I slept not at all last night, and I am tired as if I'd been on campaign all day. Arguing is weary work."
She started to say that she found it interesting, then shrugged to herself and let it be.
She would not stoop to coax tales from him as if she were a child begging for a nursery tale at bedtime. If she must learn what fared from the gossip of men in the marketplace, so be it.
he would be weary this night, and wish for nothing but sleep. She lay wakeful at his side, very late, and found herself thinking of Uther. How did it feel to know he was the choice of Ambrosius for High King, and to know he must enforce that choice, probably at sword point? She twisted impatiently, wondering if the Merlin had indeed laid an enchantment on her that she could not leave off thinking of Uther. At last she drifted into sleep, and in the country of sleep she found herself standing in the orchard where she had spoken with Uther, where she had dried his tears with her veil. Now, in the dream, he seized the end of her veil and drew her close to him with it, and laid his mouth to hers. And there was a sweetness in that kiss, a sweetness that she had never felt in all her years with Gaulois. And she found herself giving herself up to that kiss, felt her whole body melting with it. She looked into his blue eyes and thought in the dream, "I have always been a child. I have never known until this moment what it was to be a woman." She said, "I have never known what it was to love." He drew her close to him and laid his body over hers, and Igraine, feeling that warmth and sweetness suffusing her whole body, raised her lips to his again, and woke, with a start of amazement, to find that Gaulois had drawn her into his arms as he slept. The sweetness of the dream was still in her whole body, so that she put her arms round his neck with a drowsy compliance. She quickly drew impatient, waiting till he should be done, and had fallen again into a heavy, moaning sleep. And she lay awake, shaking, until dawn, wondering what had happened to her. All that week the council went on, and every night Gaulois came home pale and angry, worn out with wrangling. Once he burst out, "We sit here at talk, while on the shores the Saxon could be making ready to come to war against us. Don't the fools know that our safety depends on the treaty troops holding the Saxon shores, and that they will follow no man but Uther, or one of their own? Is Lot so prejudiced against Uther that he would rather follow a painted chief who serves the horse god?" Even the pleasures of the markets had paled. Much of that week it rained, and Igraine, who had bought some needles on her second visit, sat and mended Gauloise's clothes and her own, and wished she had her loom to do some fine weaving. She took some of the cloth she had bought, and began to make some towels by hemming them and edging them with coloured threads. In the second week her moon flux came on her, and she felt dismal and betrayed. Gaulois hadn't, after all, gotten on her the son he wanted. She wasn't yet 20. She could hardly be barren already. She thought of an old tale she had heard about a wife married to an elderly husband who bore him no son until she slipped out one night and lay with a shepherd in his field, and her old husband was mighty pleased with the fine healthy boy. If she was barren, Igraine thought resentfully, it was more likely than not to be Gauloise's fault. He was the one who was old, and his blood thinned with years of war and campaigns. And then she thought of her dream, between guilt and dismay. Merlin and Vivian had said it. She should bear a son to the High King, one who would heal the land of all this strife. Gaulois himself had said that if Ambrosius had left a son, there wouldn't be all this wrangling. If Uther were chosen High King, it would indeed be needful for him to get a son at once. "And I am young and healthy. If I were his queen, I could give him a son." And when she came again to this point, she would weep with a sudden trapped despair. "I am married to an old man, and my life is over at 19. I might as well be an old, old woman, past caring whether I live or die, fit only to sit by the fire and think of heaven." She took to her bed and told Gaulois she was ill. Once during this week the Merlin came to her lodging while Gaulois was at the council. She felt like flinging her rage and misery at him. He had begun this. She had been content and resigned to her fate until he had sent to waken her out of it. But it was unthinkable to speak rudely to the Merlin of Britain, father or no.
"Gaulois tells me you are ill, Igraine. Can I do anything to help you with my healing arts?"
She looked at him in despair. "Only if you can make me young. I feel so old, father, so old." He stroked her shining copper curls and said,
"I see no grey in your hair, nor wrinkles in your face, my child."
"But my life is over. I am an old woman, the wife of an old man."
"Hush, hush," he soothed. "You are weary and ill. You will feel better when the moon changes again, surely." "It is best like this, Igraine," he said, looking sharply at her. And she suddenly knew that he read her thoughts.
It was as if he spoke directly to her mind, repeating what he had said to her at Tintagel.
"You will bear Gaulois, no son."
"I feel trapped," she said, and put her head down and wept, and wouldn't speak again. He stroked her uncombed hair.
"Sleep is the best medicine for your illness now, Igraine. And dreams are the true remedy for what ails you. I, who am master of dreams, will send one to cure you."
He stretched his hand over her in blessing and went away. She wondered if something he had done or some spell set by Vivian was responsible. Perhaps, after all, she had conceived Gauloise's child and cast it from her. Such things had happened. She couldn't imagine the Merlin sending to dose her beer with herbs or simples, but perhaps with his power he could ensure it with magic or spells. And then she thought, perhaps it was for the best. Gaulois was old. She had seen the shadow of his death. Did she want to rear a son of his to manhood alone? When Gaulois came back to their lodging that night, it seemed that once again she could see, hovering behind him, the shadow of the dreaded fetch, his death waiting, the sword cut over his eye, his face haggard with grief and despair. And she turned her face away from him, feeling, when he touched her, that she was embraced by a dead man, a corpse.
"Come, my dear one, you must not be so dismal," Gaulois soothed, sitting on the bed beside her. "I know you are sick and wretched. You must be longing for your home and your child. But it won't be long now. I have news for you. Listen, and I'll tell you."
"Is the council any nearer to their king-making?"
"It may be," Gaulois said. "Did you hear a stir in the streets this afternoon? Well, Lot of Orkney and the kings of the north have departed. They have quite accepted it now that we will not choose Lot to be high king until the sun and the moon rise together in the west. And so they have gone forth, leaving the rest of us to do what we know Ambrosius would have willed. If I were Uther, and I told him so much, I would not walk alone after sunset. Lot went away looking like a cur who's had his tail cut off, and I wouldn't think him incapable of curing his wronged pride by sending someone with a dirk on Uther's heels."
She whispered, "Do you truly think Lot will try and kill Uther?"
"Well, he's no match for Uther in a fight. A knife in the back, that would be Lot's way. I'm as well pleased he's not one of us, though it would ease my mind if Lot were sworn to keep the peace. An oath on some holy relic he dare not flout. And even then I'd watch him," Gaulois said.
When they were in bed, he turned to her, but she shook her head and pushed him away. "Yet another day," she said. And sighing, he turned away and fell almost instantly asleep. She could not, she thought, put him off much longer. Yet a horror had come upon her now that she saw again the Doomfetch hanging over him. She told herself that whatever came, she should remain a dutiful wife to this honourable man who had been kind to her. And that brought back the memory of the room where Vivian and the Merlin had shattered her security and all her peace. She felt tears surging up inside her, but tried to quiet her sobs, not wanting to wake Gaulois. The Merlin had said that he would send her a dream to cure her misery. And yet all this had begun with a dream. She was afraid to sleep, fearing another dream would come to shatter such little peace as she had found. For she knew that this thing would shatter her life if she allowed it, lay her promised word in shreds. And although she was not herself a Christian, she had listened enough to their preaching to know that this was, by their standards, grave sin. If Gaulois were dead... Igraine caught her breath in a spasm of terror. For the first time, now, she had allowed herself to form that thought. How could she wish him dead, her husband, the father of her daughter? How could she know that even if Gaulois were no longer standing between them, Uther would want her? How could she lie at one man's side and long for another? Vivian spoke as if this kind of thing happens often. Am I simply childish and naive not to know? I will not sleep, lest I dream. If she went on tossing about like this, Igraine thought, Gaulois would wake. If she wept, he would wish to know why. And what could she tell him? Silently, Igraine slid from the bed, wrapped her long cloak about her naked body, and went to sit by the remnants of the dying fire. Why, she wondered, staring into the flames, should the Merlin of Britain, druid priest, adviser of kings, messenger of the gods, meddle this way in the affairs of a young woman's life? For that matter, what was a druid priest doing as king's counsellor at a court supposedly Christian? If I think the Merlin so wise, why am I not willing to do his will? After a long time, she felt her eyes tiring as she stared at the dying fire, and wondered if she should go back and lie down at Gaulois's side, or if she should get up and walk about, lest she sleep and risk the Merlin's promised dream. She rose and walked silently across the room to the house door. In her present mood, she wasn't altogether surprised to look back and see that her body still sat, cloak-wrapped, before the fire. She didn't trouble to unbolt the door of the room, nor later the great front door of the house, but slipped through them both like a wraith. And yet, outside, the courtyard of the house of Gaulois's friend was gone. She stood on a great plain where a ring of stone stood in a great circle just touched by the rising light of dawn. No, that light wasn't the sun. It was a great fire to the west, so that the sky stood all on fire. To the west, where stood the lost lands of Lyoness and Ys, and the great isle of Atlas and Lemnosis, or Atlantis, the forgotten kingdom of the sea. There indeed had been the great fire where the mountain had blown apart, and in a single night 100,000 men, women, and little children had perished. But the priests knew, said a voice at her side. For the past 100 years they have been building the Star Temple here on the plains, so that they might not lose count of the tracking of the seasons, or of the coming of eclipses of the moon and sun. These people here, they know nothing of such things. But they know we are wise, priests and priestesses from over the sea, and they will build for us, as they did before. Igraine looked up, without surprise, at the blue-cloaked figure by her side. and although his face was very different, and he wore a strange high headdress crowned with serpents, and golden serpents about his arms, torques or bracelets, his eyes were the eyes of Uther Pendragon. The wind grew cold over the high windswept plain where the stone ring awaited the sun, rising over the heelstone. With the eyes of her living body, Igraine had never seen the Temple of the Sun at Salisbury, for the druids wouldn't go near it. Who, they demanded, could worship the greater gods behind the gods in a temple built by human hands? And so they held their rites within groves of trees, planted by the hands of the gods. But when she was a girl, Vivian had told her of it, precisely calculated by arts lost today, so that even those who didn't know the secrets of the priests could tell when eclipses were to come and trace the movements of stars and seasons. Igraine knew that Uther, at her side, or was it indeed Uther, this tall man in the robe of a priesthood drowned centuries ago in a land now called legend, was looking westward at the flaming sky? "So, at last it has come, as they told us," he said, and laid his arm about her shoulders. "I never truly believed it till this moment, Morgan." For a moment, Igraine, wife of Gorlois, wondered why this man should call her by the name of her child. Yet even as she formed the question in her mind, she knew that Morgan wasn't a name, but the title of a priestess, meaning no more than woman come from the sea, in a religion which even the Merlin of Britain would have found a legend, and the shadow of a legend. She heard herself say, without volition, "I too found it impossible that Lioness and Ataraf and Ruta should fall and vanish away as if they had never been. Do you believe it is true that the gods are punishing the land of Atlantis for their sins?"
"I don't believe the gods work that way," the man at her side said. "The land trembles in the great ocean beyond the ocean we know. And although the people of Atlantis spoke of the lost lands of Mu and Hebrasil, still I know that in the greatest ocean beyond the sunset, the land shakes and islands rise and disappear, even where the folk know nothing of sin or evil, but live as the innocent ones before the gods gave us knowledge to choose good or ill. And if the earth gods wreak vengeance on the sinless and the sinful alike, then this further destruction cannot be punishment for sins, but is in the way of all nature. I do not know if there is purpose in this destruction, or whether the land is not yet settled into its final form, even as we men and women are not yet perfected. Perhaps the land, too, struggles to evolve its soul and perfect itself. I don't know, Morgan. These things are matters for the highest initiates. I know only that we have brought away the secrets of the temples, which we were pledged never to do, and thus we are forsworn."
She said, shaking, "But the priests bade us to do so."
"No priest can absolve us for that oath-breaking, for a word sworn before the gods resonates throughout time. And so we will suffer for it. It was not right that all the knowledge of our temple should be lost beneath the sea. And so we were sent away to bring the knowledge out, in full knowledge that we should suffer, life to life, for the breaking of that vow. It had to be, my sister."
She said resentfully, "Why should we be punished beyond this life for what we were bidden to do? Did the priests think it right that we should suffer for obeying them?"
"No," said the man. "But remember the oath we swore."
And his voice suddenly broke.
"Swore in a temple now lost under the sea, where great Orion shall rule no more. We swore to share the lot of him who stole fire from heaven,
that man should not live in darkness.
Great good came of that gift of fire, but great evil too, for man learned misuse and wickedness. And so he who stole the fire, even though his name is revered in every temple for bringing the light to mankind, suffers forever the torments where he is chained, with the vulture gnawing ever at his heart. These things are mysteries, that man can obey the priests blindly and the laws they make, and live in ignorance, or he can disobey wilfully, following the bringer of light, and bear the sufferings of the wheel of rebirth. And look. He pointed upward to where the figure of the greater than gods swung, the three stars of purity and righteousness, and choice in his belt. He stands there still, though his temple is gone. And look, there the wheel swings through his revolving path, even though the earth below may writhe in torment and cast temples and cities and mankind into a fiery death. And we have built here a new temple, so that his wisdom need never die. The man she knew to be Uther within laid his arm about her, and she knew that she was weeping. He pulled her face roughly up to his and kissed her, and she tasted salt from his own tears on his lips. He said, "I cannot regret it. They tell us in the temple that true joy is found only in freedom from the wheel that is death and rebirth, that we must come to despise earthly joy and suffering, and long only for the peace of the presence of the eternal. Yet I love this life on earth, Morgan. And I love you with a love that is stronger than death. And if sin is the price of binding us together, life after life across the ages, then I will sin joyfully and without regret, so that it brings me back to you, my beloved." Never in all her life had Igraine known a kiss such as this one. Passionate, and yet it seemed as if some essence beyond mere lust held them bound to each other. At that moment, memory flooded through her of where she had first known this man. Of the great marble pillars and golden stairs of the great temple of Orion, and of the city of the serpent below, with the avenue of sphinxes, beasts with bodies as of lions and faces of women, leading up the great road to the temple. Here they stood on a barren plain with a ring of undressed stones, and a fire to the west that was the dying light of the land of their birth, where they had dwelt together in the temple since they were little children, and where they had been joined together in the holy fire, never to be parted while they should live. And now they had done that which would join them beyond death, too. "I love this land," he said violently again. "Here we stand, where the temples are made with unhewn stone, and not with silver and gold and orichalcum. But already I love this land, so that I willingly give my life to keep it safe, this cold land where the sun never shines." And he shivered beneath his cloak. But Igraine pulled him round, turning their backs on the dying fires of Atlantis. "Look to the east," she said. "For always, while the light dies in the west, there is the promise of rebirth from the east." And they stood clasped together as the sun blazed, rising behind the eye of the great stone. The man whispered, "This is indeed the great cycle of life and death." And even as he spoke, he drew her to him. "A day will come when people will forget, and this will be no more than a ring of stones. But I will remember, and I will come back to you, beloved. I swear it." And then she heard the voice of the Merlin saying somberly, "Take care what you pray for you will certainly be given that." And silence. And Igraine found herself naked, wrapped only in her cloak,
huddled before the last cold ashes of the fire in her room in their lodging, and Gaulois snoring softly in the bed. Shaking, she wrapped herself tightly in the shawl and crept, chilled to the bone, back to the bed, burrowing for some remnants of warmth. Morgan. Morgaine. Had she given her child that name because it was truly one she had borne? Was it only a bizarre dream sent by the Merlin to convince her that once she had known Uther Pendragon in some former life? But that had been no dream. Dreams were confused, bizarre, a world where all is foolishness and illusion. She knew that somehow she had wandered into the land of truth, where the soul goes when the body is elsewhere, and somehow she had brought back not a dream, but a memory. One thing at least was made clear. If she and Uther had known each other, loved each other in the past, it explained why she had this tremendous sense of familiarity with him. Why he didn't seem a stranger. Why even his boorish or boyish manners seemed not offensive, but simply part of the person which he was and had always been. She remembered the tenderness with which she had dried his tears with her veil. Knowing now that she had thought, yes, he was always so. Impulsive, boyish, rushing toward what he wanted, never weighing costs. Had they truly brought the secrets of a vanished wisdom to this land generations ago, when the lost lands were newly vanished under the Western Ocean, and together incurred the penalties for that oath-breaking? Penalties? And then, not knowing why, she remembered that rebirth itself, human life, was supposed to be the penalty. Life in a human body rather than endless peace. She curved her lips in a smile, thinking, is it penalty or reward to live in this body? For thinking of the sudden wakening of her body in the arms of the man who was, or would be, or once had been Uther Pendragon, she knew as she had never known before that whatever the priest said, life, whether birth or rebirth, in this body was reward enough. She burrowed her body down in the bed and lay, not sleepy now, looking into the darkness, smiling. So Vivian and the Merlin had known, perhaps, what it was fated for her to know, that she was bound to Uther by a bond which made her tie to Gaulois merely superficial and momentary. She would do as they willed. It was part of her destiny. She and the man who now was Uther had bound themselves, many lives ago, to the fate of this land, where they had come when the old temple was buried. Now, when once again the mysteries were imperiled, this time by hordes of barbarians and wild men from the north, they returned together. It was given to her to bring to birth one of the great heroes who, so it was said, came back to life when they were needed. The king who was, and is, and will come again to save his people. Even the Christians had a version of the story, saying that when their Jesus was born, his mother had had warnings and prophecies that she would bear a king. She smiled in the darkness, thinking of the fate that was reuniting her with the man she had loved so many centuries before. Gaulois. What had Gaulois to do with her fate, except to make her ready? Otherwise, she might have been too young to understand what was to happen to her. In this life, I am not a priestess. Yet I know that I am still the obedient child of my fate, as all men and women must be. And for the priests and the priestesses, there is no tie of marriage. They give themselves, as they must, in the will of the gods, to bring forth those who are pivotal to the fates of mankind. She thought of the great constellation called the Wheel in the north. The peasants called it the Wain, or the Great Bear, shambling ever round and round the northernmost of the stars, but Igraine knew it symbolized in its coming and going the endless wheel of birth and death and rebirth. And the giant who strode across the sky, the sword hanging from his belt. For a moment it seemed to Igraine that she saw the hero who was to come with a great sword in his hand, the sword of the conqueror. The priests of the Holy Isle would make certain that he had a sword out of legends. At her side, Gaulois stirred and reached for her, and she went dutifully into his arms. Her revulsion had quite gone in tenderness and pity, nor did she have any fear that he would get her with his unwanted child. That was not her fate. Poor, doomed man, he had no part in that mystery. He was one of the once-born, or if he was not, he didn't remember, and she was glad he had the comfort of his simple faith. Later, when they rose, she heard herself singing, and Gaulois watched her curiously. "It seems that you are well again," he said, and she smiled. "Why, yes," she said. "I have never been better."
"Then the Merlin's medicine did you good," Gaulois said.
And she smiled and didn't answer. Chapter 5. It seemed that nothing else was talked of in the city for several days, that Lot of Orkney had withdrawn and gone away to the north. It was feared that this would delay the final choice, but only 3 days later, Gaulois returned to the lodging, where Igraine was putting the final stitches into a new gown from the woven cloth she had found in the market, to say that the Council of Ambrosius's advisers had done as they had known all along, that Ambrosius would have wished, and chosen Uther Pendragon to rule over all Britain as High King among the kings of the land. "But what of the North?" she asked.
"Somehow he will bring Lot to terms, or else he will fight him," Gaulois said. "I do not like Uther, but he is the best fighter we have. I'm not afraid of Lot, and I'm sure Uther doesn't fear him either."
Igraine felt the old stirring of the sight, knowing that Lot had much to do in the years to come. But she kept her peace. Gaulois had made it obvious that he didn't like to hear her speak of men's affairs, and she would rather not quarrel with a doomed man in the little time remaining to him.
"I see your new gown is finished. You shall wear it, if you will, when Uther is made High King in the church and crowned, and afterward he will hold court for all his men and all their ladies before he goes to the West Country for their king-making," he said. "He bears the name Pendragon, Greatest Dragon, from the banner he bears, and they have some superstitious ritual about dragons and kingship."
"The dragon is the same as the serpent," Igraine volunteered. "A symbol of wisdom. A druidical symbol."
Gaulois frowned, displeased, and said that he had no patience with such symbols in a Christian country. "The anointing by a bishop should be enough for them."
"But all people are not fitted for the higher mysteries," Igraine said. She had learned this as a child on the Holy Isle, and since her dream of Atlantis, it seemed to her that all the early teaching about the mysteries, which she thought she had forgotten, had assumed a new meaning and depth in her mind. "Wise men know that symbols aren't needed, but the common folk of the countryside, they need their dragons flying for the kingship, just as they need the Beltane fires and the great marriage when a king is wedded to the land."
"Those things are forbidden to a Christian," Gaulois said austerely. "The apostle has said it. There is only one name under heaven by which we may be saved, and all those signs and symbols are wicked. I wouldn't be surprised to hear it of Uther, that unchaste man, that he entangles himself in these lewd rites of pagandom, pandering to the folly of ignorant men. One day I hope to see a high king in Britain who will keep to Christian rites alone."
Igraine smiled and said, I don't think either of us will live to see that day, my husband.
Even the apostle in your holy books wrote that there was milk for babes and meat for strong men, and the common folk, the once-born, have need for their holy wells and their spring garlands and dancing rites. It would be a sad day for Britain if no Yule fires burned, and no garlands fell into the holy wells.
Even the devils can quote the holy words amiss,
Gaulois said, but not angrily.
Perhaps this is what the apostle meant when he said that women should keep silence in the churches, for they are prone to fall into those errors. When you are older and wiser, Ygraine, you will know better. Meanwhile, you can make yourself as fine as you please for the services in the church and for the merrymaking afterward.
Ygraine put on her new gown and brushed her hair until it shone like fine copper. And when she looked at herself in the silver mirror, Gaulois had sent to the market for it after all, and had it brought to her, she wondered, with a sudden fit of despondency, whether Uther would even notice her. She was beautiful, yes, but there were other women, beautiful as she was, and younger, not married women who had borne children. Why should he want her, old and used as she was? All through the long ceremonies in the church, she watched intently as Uther was sworn and anointed by their bishop. For once, the psalms weren't doleful hymns of God's wrath and punishment, but joyful songs, praising and offering thanks, and the bells sounded joyous instead of wrathful. Afterwards, in the house which had been Ambrosius's headquarters, there were delicacies and wine and much ceremony, as one by one Ambrosius's war chiefs swore allegiance to Uther. Long before it was over, Ygraine grew weary. But at last it was done, and while the chiefs and their ladies congregated around the wine and the food, she moved a little away, watching the bright gathering. And there, at last, as she had been half aware that he would, Uther found her.
"My Lady of Cornwall."
She made a deep curtsy. "My Lord Pendragon, my king." He said roughly,
"There is no need for such formalities between us now, lady."
And caught her shoulders so much as he had done in her dream that she stared, half expecting that she would see on his arms the golden serpent talks. But he only said,
"You are not now wearing the moonstone."
It was so strange, that stone. When first I saw you wearing it, it was like to a dream I had. I had fever last spring, and the Merlin attended me, and I had a strange dream. And I know now it was in that dream I first beheld you, long before ever I laid eyes on your face.
I must have stared like a country lout, Lady Ygraine, for I found myself struggling again and again to remember my dream, and what part you played in that dream, and the moonstone at your throat.
She said, "I've been told that one of the virtues of the jewel moonstone is to awaken the true memories of the soul. I too have dreamed." He laid a light hand on her arm.
"I cannot remember. Why is it that I seem to see you wearing something gold about your wrists, Ygraine? Have you a golden bracelet in the form of a dragon, perhaps?"
She shook her head. "Not now," she said, paralyzed at the awareness that he had somehow, and without her full knowledge, shared that strange memory and dream.
"You will be thinking me a boor and beyond all courtesy, my Lady of Cornwall. May I offer you some wine?"
Silently she shook her head. She knew that if she tried to take a cup in her hand, she would shake and spill it all over herself.
"I do not know what is happening to me,"
Uther said violently. "All that has happened in these days.
The death of my father and king. The strife of all these kings, their choosing me for High King.
It seems unreal,
and you, Igraine, are the most unreal of all. Have you been to the west, where the great ring of stones stands on the plain? They say that in olden time it was a druid temple. But the Merlin says not. It was built long before the druids came to these lands. Have you been there?
Not in this life, my lord.
I wish I could show it to you. For I dreamed once I was there with you. Oh, don't think me a madman, Igraine, chattering always of dreams and prophecy, he said, with that sudden boyish smile. Let us talk very sedately of ordinary things. I am a poor northern chief who has suddenly wakened to find himself High King of Britain, and perhaps I am a little mad with the strain.
I shall be sedate and ordinary, Igraine agreed with a smile. And if you were a wedded man, I would ask you how your wife did, and if your oldest son had trouble with... Oh, what is the most ordinary thing I could ask you? Whether he was done teething before the hot weather, or if he had a skin rash from his swaddling clothes.
He chuckled. You will be thinking I'm old not to be a married man, he said. I've had women enough, God knows. I shouldn't say that, perhaps, to the wife of my most Christian of chiefs. Father Jerome would say I had had all too many women for the health of my soul. But I never saw one I cared for when we rose from bedding, and I always feared that if I wedded some woman before we bedded, I would tire of her in such manner. It seemed to me always that there should be some tie stronger than that between man and woman, though the Christians seem to think that that is enough. What is it they say? It is better to marry than to burn. Well, I didn't burn, but I slaked the fire, and when I had spent it, the fire went out. And yet I feel there could be a burning which would not spend itself so quickly, and it should be such a one I could marry. Abruptly he asked her, "Do you love Gaulois?"
Vivian had asked her this, and she had said that it didn't matter. She hadn't known what she was saying. Now she said quietly, "No, I was given to him when I was too young to care what man I married."
Uther turned away and paced angrily, saying at last, "And I can see you are no wench to tumble. And why, in the name of all the gods, I must be bewitched by a woman who is wedded to one of my most loyal partisans."
So, the Merlin had worked his meddlesome magic on Uther too. But now Igraine didn't resent it. It was their destiny, and what would come must come.
But she couldn't believe it was her destiny to betray Gaulois crudely, here, like this.
It was like a part of her dream of the great plain, so that she could almost see the shadow of the great ring of stones when he laid his hand on her shoulder. But she was confused. No, that was another world and another life.
It seemed that her whole soul and body cried out within her for the reality of that kiss in their dream. She put her hands over her face and wept.
He stared at her, dismayed and helpless, backing away a little.
"Igraine," he whispered,
"what can we do?"
"I don't know," she said, sobbing. "I don't know." Her certainty had become a miserable confusion.
Had the dream been sent only to bewitch her by magic into a betrayal of Gaulois and her own honour and sworn word?
A hand fell on her shoulder, heavy and disapproving. Gaulois looked angry and suspicious. "What is this unseemly matter, my lady? What have you been saying, my king, that my wife looks so wretched? I know you, a man of lewd manners and little piety, but even so, sire, common decency should restrain you from approaching a vassal's wife at your crowning."
Igraine raised her face to him in anger. "Gaulois, I have not deserved this of you. "'What have I ever done that you should cast such an accusation at me in a public place?'
For indeed, heads were turning now, hearing angry words spoken.
"'Then why, lady, do you weep if he has said nothing unseemly to you?'
His hand, gripping her wrist, felt as if he would crush it.
"'As for that,' Uther said, "'you must ask the lady why she weeps, for I do not know. "'But loose her arm, or I will make you. "'Husband or no, no one shall handle any woman roughly in my house.'
"'Gorlois let go of Igraine's arm. "'She could see the marks of his fingers already reddening into dark bruises. "'She rubbed the marks, tears streaming down her face.' Before the many faces surrounding them, she was appalled as if she had been taken and shamed. She covered her face with her veil and wept harder than ever. Gorlois pushed her before him. She didn't hear what he said to Uther. Only when they were outside in the street did she stare at him amazed.
He said in a rage,
"I will not accuse you before all men, Igraine. But God is my witness I should be justified in doing so. Uther looked at you just now as a man looks at a woman he has known, as no Christian man has a right to know any other man's wife."
Igraine, feeling her heart pounding in her breast, knew it was true, and felt confusion and despair. In spite of the fact that she had seen Uther only four times, and dreamed twice of him, she knew that they had looked at each other, and spoken to each other, as if they had been lovers for many years, knowing all, and more than all, about each other, body and mind and heart. She recalled her dream, where it seemed that they had been bound for many years by a tie which, if it was not marriage, might as well have been so. Lovers, partners, priest to priestess, whatever it was called. How could she tell Gorlois that she had known Uther only in a dream, but that she had begun to think of him as the man she had loved so long ago that Igraine herself was not yet born? Was a shadow. That the essence within her was one and the same with that woman who had loved that strange man who bore the serpents on his arms in gold. How could she say this to Gorlois, who knew, and wished to know, nothing of the mysteries? He pushed her ahead of him into their lodging. He was ready, she knew, to strike her if she had spoken, but her silence frustrated him even more. He shouted, "Have you nothing to say to me, my wife?" and gripped her already bruised arm so strongly that she cried out anew with the pain of his hand. "Did you think I did not see how you looked at your paramour?" She wrenched her arm away from him, feeling as if he would actually tear it out of the socket. "If you saw that, then you saw me turn away from him when he would have had no more than a kiss. And did you not hear him say to me that you were his loyal supporter, and he would not take the wife of his friend?"
"If I was ever his friend, I am so no more," Gorlois said, his face dark with fury. "Do you truly think I shall support a man who would take my wife from me in a public place, shaming me before all his assembled chiefs?"
"He did not," Igraine cried out, weeping. "I have never so much as touched his lips." It seemed all the more vicious, since she had indeed desired Uther, but had kept herself scrupulously away from him. "Why, if I am to be accused of guilt when I am innocent of any wrongdoing, even as he would call it so, why should I not have done what Uther wished?"
"I saw how you looked at him, and you have kept apart from my bed since first you set eyes on Uther, you faithless whore."
"How do you dare?" she gasped, raging, and caught up the silver mirror he had given her, flinging it at his head. "Take back that word, or I swear I will throw myself into the river before ever you touch me again. You lie, and you know you lie." Gorlois ducked his head, and the mirror crashed against the wall. Igraine snatched off her amber necklace another new gift from her husband, and flung it after the mirror. With hasty fingers, tore off the fine new gown and hurled it at his head. "How dare you call me such names, who have loaded me with gifts as if I were one of your camp followers and fancy women? If you think me a whore, where are the gifts I have received from my lovers? All the gifts I have are given me by my husband, the hoarse and foul-mouthed cullion, who tries to buy my goodwill for his own lusts, because the priests have made him half a eunuch. From now on I will wear the weaving of my own fingers, not your disgusting gifts, you knave whose mouth and mind are as foul as your filthy kisses." "Be silent, you evil-minded scold," Gaulois shouted, striking her so hard that she fell to the ground. "Now get up and cover yourself decently as a Christian woman should, not tearing off your clothes so that I will go mad with looking at you like that. Is that how you seduced my king into your arms?" She scrambled to her feet, kicking the ruins of the gown as far as she could, and rushed at him, striking his face again and again. He grabbed her, trying to hold her motionless, crushed her into his arms. Igraine was strong, but Gaulois was a big man and a warrior, and after a moment her struggles subsided, knowing they were useless. He whispered, pushing her toward the bed, "I will teach you better than to look at any man that way except your rightful husband." She flung her head back in contempt and said, "Do you think I would ever look at you again except with the loathing I would feel for a snake? Oh, yes, you can take me to bed and force me to do your will. Your Christian piety permits you to ravish your own wife. I do not care what you say to me, Gaulois, because I know in my own heart that I am innocent. Until this very moment I felt guilty that some witchcraft or spell had made me love Uther. Now I wish I had done what he begged of me, if only because you were as ready to believe lies of my guilt as the truth about my innocence. And while I was anxious for my own honour and yours, you were prepared to believe that I would fling mine to the winds." The contempt in her voice made Gaulois drop his arms and stare at her. He said, his voice husky, "Do you mean that, Igraine? Are you truly innocent of wrongdoing?" "Do you think I would stoop to lie about it? To you?" "Igraine, Igraine," he said humbly, "I know well I am too old for you, that you were given to me without love and without your will. But I thought, perhaps, in these days, you have come to think a little better of me. And when I saw you weeping before Uther..." His voice choked. "I could not bear it, that you should look like that at that lustful and vicious man, and look on me only with duty and resignation. Forgive me, forgive me, I do beg it of you, if indeed I wronged you." "You wronged me," she said, her voice stinging with ice, "and you do well to beg my pardon, which you shall not have until the hells rise and the earth sinks beneath the western ocean. Better you should go and make your peace with Uther. Do you truly think you can stand against the wrath of the High King of Britain? Or will you end by buying his favour as you sought to buy mine?" "Be still," Gaulois said angrily, his face flushing. He had humbled himself before her, and she knew he would never forgive her for that either. "Cover yourself." Igraine realized that she was still bare to the waist. She went to the bed where her old gown was lying, and pulled it leisurely over her head, doing up the laces. He gathered up her amber necklace from the floor, and the silver mirror, and held them out to her. But she turned her eyes away and ignored them. And after a while he laid them on the bed, where she let them lie without looking at them. He stared at her for a moment, then pushed the door and went out. Left alone, Igraine began to put her things into her saddlebags. She didn't know what she meant to do, Perhaps she would go and find the Merlin, take him into her confidence. It was he who had begun this train of events that had put her and Gaulois at such odds.